don't love you back. Stay tuned every Wednesday at 11:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 8:30 Pacific, with your host, Boyd and Lucinda, for the hottest talk show in existence. The streets don't love you back.
Good evening and welcome to the Streets Don't Love You Back show. Today is August 17th, 2011. I'm your host, Lucinda, with my co-host, Boyd. And our topic is, as always, the streets don't love you back. Join us every Wednesday night with real people, real stories, and real changes as we hear the truth about gangs, drugs, violence, abuse, and other life issues. We have a great show for you tonight. We have Miss Nadj Insolente from calling all the way from Paris, France. And she has a story. Nadj was abandoned. She was sexually abused. She had turned to cutting on herself, turned to drugs, ended up being raped and prostituted, and ended up living on the streets in New York. She almost died from an infection from a needle, and that was 12 years ago. So we have Nadj here today to share her story, one of survival and overcoming. And she's also writing a book about this to tell her story. So we're going to get her story firsthand tonight. And before we do that, let me welcome Boyd to the show.
Yeah, I would like to say thanks, ladies and gentlemen, for always tuning in Wednesday night. And like the missus said, we have a great show for you tonight with a young lady calling all the way from Paris, France to deliver her powerful testimony, and hopefully tonight it'll reach someone's ears and touch someone's life. So we're just asking you to stay tuned in and get ready for your blessing tonight. So without further ado, we'll pass the mic directly over to the young lady, and she will specifically introduce herself, and we'll start.
Okay, hello, I'm Nadj, and I lived a life of sins, and what is important to me is that someone out there knows that you can get out. You can get out of this life. I didn't start really well, and I could take that as an excuse. But I am responsible, and I wish someone would have told me that. You can go on with the life you had when you were a kid and keep hurting yourself. I was abandoned, and I was sexually abused, and I thought, you owed me all. You owed me everything. And I didn't want to suffer. I didn't want to feel. And everything that I did was in that frame of mind. I didn't want to feel. So, of course, when drugs appeared in my life, it was like a blessing. It was like, oh, my God, I found something. Something that makes that I don't care. That I don't care about anything, or that I don't care that my dad is not here, that my mom is not here, that they all never fought for me. Something that takes all that away. And, you know, that was way after I started cutting myself, which was like when I was about 7. And nobody noticed. My family, my foster family, nobody noticed that I was cutting on myself. And, you know, it's a shame. Look at your children, because they tell you things, you know. And I wish, but it wasn't like that. So, you know, it's okay. It made me what I am today, and I am grateful for that. You know, I don't hold resentments towards anybody, neither in my family, you know, outside my family. I ended up in New York. I was 20, and it was the fiesta. I was like, oh, my God, I don't speak English. I can do whatever I want. And, you know, and I ended up pretty much in the street within a year, because my friends left and they said, you coming home? And I was like, no, I'm staying in New York. You know, the dope is good, and why go anywhere else? That's what I want to do. And you know, when you think like that, nothing good can happen. Nothing. And, you know, I spoke and talked and sweat drugs. That's all I cared about. You know, it was all my life, my lover, my family, it was everything to me. I loved that stuff till it killed me almost, you know, and it's really, really, you got to be really hard-headed, you know, to survive. I was thinking about what can I possibly say that could help somebody, and, you know, and I was thinking back about stuff that I went through, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, I survived. I survived. That's amazing. And I should be dead, you know. And I ended up, you know, being raped by a gang. I got raped by a guy when I was prostitute who nearly killed me. And, you know, and I thought, oh, it's okay. It's okay because, you know, I'm going to die tonight, and they're not going to find me. That's what bothers me. But, and then, you know, what it took for me, and that's why, like, it doesn't have to go that far. And what it took for me is that I couldn't walk because of that needle on my knee. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, my whole body got infected, and I didn't know I had a needle in my knee. And I, you know, my leg got tripled, and I couldn't walk, and I still went on another 3 days, dragging my leg, you know, couldn't stop because I thought, because you started thinking after a while, like, you have no soul anymore. You're not important to anyone. You start thinking it doesn't matter. And you're not going to survive this in any kind of way pure possible. You know, you're not going to leave that out. You're not going to leave that down. So why does it matter? And I used to look at the other girls, and I used to think, I wonder if they have a mother, if they have a sister, if they have someone out there that, like, is worried for them at this instant. I wonder if they remember the childhood and if they remember some things that were good. See, I had flashes of things that were not so bad in my head, and I was like, oh, my God, how did I get here? And where you were invisible and where you, like, the you know, the people look at you in the street and you're like, oh, they're, like, disgusted with you, you know? And that's a terrible place to be. It's a terrible place to be, and you get arrested every week, and you know, you get in trouble, you get beat up, you get, you know, the drugs are not drugs, you know, it doesn't end. It's every day drama, 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 every day. So I personally, I had to go that far, which I don't hope on anyone, not even my enemies, because it's really, really hard. And, you know, I want to give a message of hope that, like, you can decide and get help. And then you can do it. You can get out. And, like, you know, who would have thought? We were 4 girls here in my hometown in France that were doing drugs and were crazy a little and, you know, doing what we were doing. And I'm the only one alive. You know, who would have thought? And, you know, they all died from this disease. And this disease of addiction is like a monster. You know, it lives in your head and it doesn't let go. And even now, I have to, you know, work on that because it goes in all areas of your life. You know, if you don't have it, the problem is not the drugs. The problem is me. I need to work on me to change. I need to find God. You know, because I think a lot of addicts, a lot of alcoholics have that God-shaped hole, that thing that we want to feed that's never fed. And, you know, it's for me, when I stopped using, it was like that. It was like I felt so empty, and I needed God. I needed to give my life to a higher power, that to do something with it, because I surely couldn't do anything with it. And that was my thing. It was like, okay, how do I do that? How do I do that? Well, you start by praying, you know. I mean, it doesn't have to be Jesus. It doesn't have to be. At the beginning, you just pray and thank God that you're not in the street. And thank God that you're not being beat up tonight. And that, to me, was already something to be grateful for, even if my life was not great for a long time, you know, because it takes a while, and it takes some perseverance, and takes some trust in the process. And sometimes it's hard at the beginning. I mean, for all the people that stop one day is amazing for us. It's an event. It's like, oh my God, I stopped one day. And if you can stop one day, you can stop 10 years, you know. And I think people let go before the miracle happens. And
right.
I'm here to say the miracle can happen. So
exactly.
I think that you are responsible for your life after a while. And someone needs to tell you that. Someone needs to tell you that it's not because you've been abused, you've been abandoned, or you've been prostitute, or you've been, that you can change your life. You, at one point, you got to get up and say, I am responsible and I need to change this.
Right, exactly.
And that's what happened to me.
Right, and I just want to ask you a question. You know, the message is very powerful, and I just wanted to say what really made you want to change your life and leave that behind? You know, what would you tell these youngsters that's still going through that? What made you get to that turning point?
Well, unfortunately for me, like I said, I couldn't walk, and I wasn't thinking stopping at all, because I thought it was too late. I had gone too far. Nothing mattered to me no more, and I just wanted to die. I prayed to die every day, and here I was. I would sleep an hour, and here I was awake again, and I was like, oh my God, I'm still here. I'm not dying, you know. And it was like 6 years of that. 6 years, I woke up and I was like, fuck, oh, sorry, I'm still alive. I'm still alive, God. And I prayed to God, please take me, because I'm not useful here. And then when I couldn't walk, I still went on. And finally, I couldn't walk at all. Like, I was laid in the hallway, and I couldn't walk. And somebody called for me to get to the hospital. And when I went there, I was like, still not willing. I was like, okay, do your thing, because I got to go.
Right.
And I was really nasty, and I was like freaking out, because I was thinking, oh my God, if I don't get out of here in 2 hours, I'm not going to be straight, and it's going to be horrible. And, you know, and so he comes and he tells me I have a needle in my knee.
Wow.
And you have to take it out. And I'm like, well, go get your scalpel and get it out.
Right.
And he's like,
no doubt.
No, we can't, because you have an infection and you need to be 15 days under antibiotics before we can go in your knee. I was like, well, that's out of the question because I got to go.
Right.
So they put me to sleep. They put me to sleep and took me to the lock floor. And I woke up at 2 in the morning sick and in bed and pajamas and stuff.
Wow.
And it's only 2 weeks later that I started waking up in my head, that I started thinking, wow, I'm not feeling so bad. It's okay. I started calling people I knew that were clean and sober. And they called me back, and they started telling me, what are you going to do now? Those were really good friends of mine. And because I was sober and clean before 6 years, and I had kept contact with these people, even though I was using. And they were calling me saying, we have a solution. You want to hear it? And at first I was like, not really. And then the solution was Florida. And I was like, Florida? Oh, no. It's out of the question. I'm not going to Florida. I hate
right.
Florida. And I was like, no. And are you willing to do something to change? And I was like, a part of me was like, no, not really. No, I'm not going to Florida. I go and do whatever I have to do here, but I'm not going to Florida. But it took another week after that for them to convince me. And I went to Florida. They put their money together, my friends, and sent me in a halfway house. And they paid for me.
Uh-huh.
They paid for my plane, and they paid for me to stay 3 weeks there without having to worry about nothing until I found a job in Florida. And that's how I started. And then it was lifted. I mean, I prayed the whole time, but it was lifted. The desire left me. I must say that, like, drugs were not working for me anymore. Like, it didn't matter what I did and how much. It wasn't working. So finally, after a couple of months of being clean and sober, I was like, well, this is a little bit the same. Because it wasn't working anymore, so I feel a little bit the same. So I did what I had to do, and I got a job, and I have a friend that paid my rent for almost a year to like help me, and then I ended up working in rehabs. In Florida. I hate Florida, but I love my job. You know, working in rehabs is the best job on earth for a person like me, because you're there, they come, they're in the same shape that you were, and you can give them some hope. You can send them the message that, like, you know, yeah, you can go as far as I went, and you can get back. So if you didn't go as far as I went, you can get back, too. You don't have to go that far.
Right, exactly.
You know, this is not a requirement.
At all.
So
you can try to slow it down before it get out of control, you know?
Exactly. You don't need to go to all the lengths to get your drugs. There's a point where when you know, you think about this all day long, and that's what your problem is, then you need to look at it and you need to do something about it before you're a prostitute on 12th Street.
No doubt.
You don't need to go there.
We got a caller for you, and we're going to go to that caller with the last four digits, 271.
Okay.
Caller, you're in the air.
Hey, what's going on? This is Josh.
What's up, good
How
brother?
Are you?
We got the young lady on the line. Would you like to ask her a question, Josh?
Yeah, most definitely, most definitely. First of all, you know, I just want to say I'm hearing what you got to say, and I'm totally feeling you. My mom was an alcoholic and a drug addict, and, you know, by the grace of God, she's been sober now for about 20 years. But I want to know, do you ever have a desire to go back? I mean, when things are, when you're having a real rough day, when you're struggling, you know, maybe to pay your bills or you know, things are just not going exactly how you expected them to go, do you ever have that desire to go back, the drugs?
Well, it comes and goes. It's, and I know it's going to come and go for the rest of my life, and I've made peace with that. And the thing is that I don't have to act up on it anymore. It comes less and less as time goes by, because time goes by, and, you know, you don't think about it. The first couple of years, you think about it, and then more often, and you dream about it, and all of that stuff. And then after that, it's kind of like, it happens maybe once a year where you're like, oh, my God, I'm really having this important obsession here. And you take care of it because, you know, that's that you tell somebody. You tell somebody, you say, you know, I want to, I'm thinking I really want to shoot dope, you know. And it's becoming an obsession, and people will help you. I've learned that. And they'll help you, we talk to it, and we remember where it brought you. And you don't want to be where it brought you. And, you know, often when you already stopped for a long time, you don't, you know, it, you might think about it, but you don't actually go to do it. Some people do. Some people do and come back immediately because it's the same out there. The streets don't change. The drugs don't change. The scene don't change. You know? So, no, I don't really think about doing drugs, you know.
Right, right. That's awesome. That's awesome.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, and we just like to say,
hang in here with us, Josh, all the way
from past France.
Nadej, I wanted to go back a little bit to when you were you were abandoned as a baby. Do you know why or what happened to your parents?
Well, what happened was, and I had my little sister wrote abandoned on my wall this afternoon with an interrogation point, because she doesn't understand, because she grew up with my dad. And my dad and my mom left me in a family first, and then the family couldn't keep me at night, so they put me in another family because they were separated, and my dad was driving trucks and my mom was working in clubs, and so they, neither of them could take care of me, so they left me in this family. And neither of them really took care of what was going on after that. They didn't come back till I was like 7. And the family just kept me. And even though there was no paperwork and didn't have to, they just kept me and dragged me along. They opened a restaurant, and I went with them, and they changed town. I went with them, and then my mom and my dad started coming back to take me on vacation, and it was horrible for me because I was like, these are two strangers that take me away. Are they taking me back?
Right.
Are they going to take me back? It was all, for me, it was just awful vacations. You know,
well,
I didn't like my dad.
That feeling of abandonment that you must have had, you know, here's, you know, my mom and dad, and they're out doing their thing, and I'm just left over here with whoever, here and there, and then you were abused, abused by one of the foster grandfathers?
I was abused after by the foster grandfather, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was that on one side, and there was on the other side the fear of being abandoned again, of being kind of a pound, you know, the kind of a thing on a checkboard, you know.
Right.
And I remember when I was 10 months, and I remember feeling the cold floor in the new house and feeling fear. You know, mm-hmm. I remember that really clearly. So, you know, yeah, I say they abandoned me.
Right. And as a child, you know, obviously you felt that abandonment and you felt unwanted and like you said, like a checkerboard, I'm here and there and over here and over there and jumping around.
And nobody fights for me.
Right, like nobody cared. So how does that affect your self-esteem? And then also at that young age, maybe you can explain a little bit to the listeners how it was that you ended up cutting your wrist and cutting on yourself to make yourself feel better, or how did that all happen?
Well, I just felt a lot of fear all the time, and I felt like I was different. Because everybody at school had a family.
Right.
And everybody, like, ate with their family. Like, at certain hours, they had rules. They did their homework. They did all that. And me, nobody looked after me. So I did whatever I wanted. And they had a restaurant, and they were really busy. And I ate either before or after. I never ate with anybody at the table. You know, it was kind of like that. And then the grandfather came and lived with us. It was like he came out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and that started, I was 7 when it started, so, and I hated him. And I was forced to eat with him, and because he ate with me after when he first came. But I, you know, I hated him. And at the same time, I felt guilty.
Right.
Because
you
felt like...
Yeah, there's the shame and the guilt.
Yeah. Yeah, and if, I don't know why I started cutting myself. I don't know where I heard it or where I found the idea. But I remember the one day, the first day I did it, and feeling... a huge relief, and I just went on from that, you know.
Right.
It was like, oh my God, like I saw the blood, and I was like really relieved. And I don't, you know, right. I mean, I later learned going to therapy for a while that children do that to focus the pain on something else.
Right.
And makes sense. It's like, you know, you hurt yourself so you can focus on that instead of focusing on what you feel inside.
Right. And then that kind of becomes addictive to some young kids.
Totally. Totally mm-hmm. addicted. I had a harder time stopping that. Because when I first... get clean, I was like, whenever something went wrong, I turned to that.
You know, and maybe you can explain. Maybe you can explain a little bit, even better, how, because people that have never gone through anything like that, they're, you know, how could, and people, some people never imagine cutting themselves or, you know, sticking themselves with a needle or. You know, but to cut yourself, you know it's going to hurt, and most people wouldn't ever do it. You know, so
yeah.
Kind of explain a little bit more how.
Well, it is
cutting
an addiction.
And causing that pain.
I think it's an addiction, and from what I've learned from therapy, it's an addiction, and it's something you do generally very young, and then it takes toll on you. But it's because something goes on in your life that's really painful. And then you know,
it's just trying to hide a different hurt in a different way.
Well,
making yourself hurt to cover up another
I didn't think of any different way because I felt lost and I felt like there was nobody there. So, you know, I kind of like went with whatever I had under my hand. And for me, it was that. And I remember breaking a glass and doing it the first time, and I don't know why it came to that. But I remember doing it very clearly, and I remember the feeling of relief I got. And then it became a habit.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing it all the time. And even when I did alcohol, the first few years of alcohol, every single time I would cut myself. So, and I never quite understood until the therapist told me, well, you know, this is how it works. And you put the pain somewhere else so you can focus on that.
Right.
You know, because you're bleeding.
So you're
bleeding so you can, you know, take care of it and be nice to it. And it takes it away from your belly or your heart, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You're busy doing something else. So, but I don't quite understand. I mean, I understand that, but I, you know, I don't know why I start doing that. It boggles the mind to think a kid of seven would do that.
For some kids, it could be to get attention, to have somebody pay attention to you. You know,
yeah,
oh my gosh,
that was a part of it too.
Uh-huh.
I think that was a part of it too because I felt invisible.
Right.
You know, and
right.
I felt like, you know, like even now when I see movies with, like, kids in it and parents that come and, like, read them a story, I'm like, oh, my God, I so would have loved that. I so would have loved that.
Right.
And it's like I'm so jealous. I'm like, oh, my God, I want that. You know, and I didn't have kids, so that's a big regret in my life. But I think it might have changed that because it would have been everything to me. But I would have given that to my kids.
Right. So can you tell the viewers how long have you been clean now and spreading your message? And then we'll talk a little bit about your upcoming book.
I'm clean 12 years. 12 years
great,
in June.
Congratulations.
Great.
And I've worked in rehabs for 9 years in Florida.
So
that was a blessing for me. And I still have women, and in my Facebook, I have women that were in the rehabs I work at and still thank me for being there for them and listening to them and stuff. And,
What brought the book on?
And then, you know, when I was doing, I was writing a little before and everybody was telling me, man, with the life you had, you should really write a book and help somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh my God, that's a long thing to write.
but
that's
not the wrong thing, though, because there's too many people who have gone through, you know, similar things. There's too many people out here that are hurting because of sex abuse and drugs and things, you know.
Yeah.
And they need people like you that can be strong and have been courageous enough to get through it and survive it to be able to tell their stories to help them.
Yeah, and the thing was also, like, I didn't want to hurt anybody alive still, but then I thought about it and I thought, well, I won't, you know, if I get, a, you know, an editor and I publish that book, it won't be published in France for just now, and they don't speak English, so it won't be a problem.
Right.
But Because, you know, my dad is still saying now, I don't talk to him much because we don't get along, and, you know, I still, it's not that I have a resentment, but when I'm with him, it's like fire and oil, you know, it's like, it's horrible. It's like the first one that says something to the other one to, like, start a fight. And then since I'm not scared of him anymore, I fight back. So, and I keep telling myself, you need to let it go. You need to let it go because he's not going to change. But I have a hard time with him. And I see him, I haven't seen him in 3 years. And I spoke with him once this year on the phone. So you see, it's not the great relationship. I came back for, you know, because I came back to France hoping to find a family that I didn't have and maybe make peace with my father and my mom. And, you know, even though they're not what I thought parents should have been, they're my parents, and I want to forgive and forget, and I want to be there for them if they need me, and I want to do what, you know, what I think is right.
Right.
What happened
to your mom? But he's not letting me in, and my mom is totally disappeared. We don't even know where she is.
Wow.
So everything I came for is not here. So I'm coming back.
Right. And we got another
I'm going back to LA.
Right. We got another caller for you too. Last four digits.
Okay.
5546.
Hold on.
Yeah, caller, you're on the air. Yeah, you're on the air, caller.
Hey, what's going on, Rob?
Hey, what's up, Shaka, man? You know, we are here talking to the young lady tonight, and we appreciate you calling in. And she's calling all the way from Paris, France tonight. So we're definitely glad you're tuning in. And you like to ask any questions, you can go ahead. You know, the floor is on you.
Yeah, I just want to know what really gives her the perseverance to tell her story and just keep on moving ahead.
What's the question?
Like what gives you your drive and your, you know, your strength to keep on
I personally, and that's just a choice personally, I think I get it from God. God is like the way for me, and I believe that, like, you pray and you do the right thing, and good things happen in your life, and not always. Sometimes it's hard, but you know, I just have faith, you know, that, like, things are going to eventually be all right. You know, I keep going. I'm stubborn.
You know what? Right, that's thank you for sharing that with me.
Oh, you're welcome.
All right, we appreciate that. We appreciate you stopping in tonight, Shaka. And we're going to let her finish talking a little bit more about her upcoming book. We'd like to hear that. And you just hold fast for a few minutes, and we'll let her speak on that as well, about the book. All right, you got the floor again.
Okay. Well, the book, I started writing it a few months back. I thought it was going to be a few months thing. But it looks like it's going to be a little more than that because, you know, you got to give details. You got to give, you know, it's like I start at 10 months old. So, of course, you know, there's all I've felt. And that's what's important, I think, because I think a lot of people feel that way and don't say it or feel different or feel like they don't belong or feel like unloved or feel like the only solution for them is destroying themselves because nobody cares about them.
Right.
And I talk about that a lot, about how I felt when I was little and when I went to school and when I was abused and how I felt about that. And I felt like, you know, he did that to me because I was a bastard to him. It was an old man. And he
right.
never touched, I'm sure, and nobody in the family. But I was nobody. And that's why he did it to me. Because I was not a part of the family in his book. So I'm sure he had abused other children before. Not after, because he died. But I talk about that, and I talk about mostly the way I felt about the things that were happening in my life and I had no control over, you know, and the way I felt about my dad, that was a bear and didn't say anything to me and never gave me any tenderness or love. He couldn't barely talk. He never said that to anybody. He loved them, and you know, and that's not what I ask him now. I had a fight with him because that's why we're not talking much lately. Because I wanted him to say he was sorry.
Right.
And he's not capable of giving me that.
Right, but that's what you're looking
for. That's okay, but that's a little hard for me. So I talk about that, and I talk about my little sister arriving and her being the queen all of a sudden. And I was 10 years old, and he never took care of me. And why was he taking care of that baby? You know, like things that I didn't understand when I was 10. So, like, it's full of feelings and things that went on in my head.
Right.
And I know that, like, from working in rehabs, I know that many young girls, many, many, many young girls have the same experience than me, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They've been abused. They've been taken for granted. They've been not taken care of. All of that. And
right.
all of them have that past. And they're sometimes 17, 16.
Mm-hmm.
And I am grateful that I have been there for certain of these young women to tell them, you don't need to go on this way.
Exactly.
You know, and that's what I want the book to be about. I want it to be, well, this is an awful story, and this is what you'll get. This is what you'll get. Do you want to live there? Do you want to be there? You know, and the thing is, like, to let them know there is a solution. Nobody told me there was a solution.
Right.
You know, I mean, when I was young, I thought the solution was getting loaded, and that was it.
Right.
There was nobody to say, look, Nadege, we know you have this and that, and that's not cool. And but you don't
need
to go on this way.
Right. And
so on my book,
the young girls that get abused too, they have those feelings of low self-esteem and I'm not worth anything and I'm just trash. Like
course.
You said, I'm nobody, but.
Exactly.
But you really are, and you have to realize that those things are not your fault and have to get over that.
Yes, and I think a lot of them don't really know it deep inside. I think they kind of think it's their fault, because I remember for me when the therapist told me to say it wasn't my fault, I couldn't say it. And I know after that, again, from my experience in working in rehabs, that a lot of young ladies out there think that they're in some ways at fault for this.
Right.
And
then
you need
also,
to, like,
Right. When that happens, too, you feel like you're not worthy of anything or that you're not worth it. Like, you know, just like you said, I was nobody, but you are. I mean, you are somebody. But that's how it made you feel, and at a young age like that, not having anyone to protect you or talk to you or tell you that, you know, when somebody touches you, that's wrong. Or when, you know.
Yeah,
We're getting better at that now. But, you know, years ago, things like that just weren't talked about.
Yes. And that's what I'm saying also. It's like now it's more, you know, it's a thing that everybody knows, sexual abuse. But back then, when I was a kid, it was not talked about, and, you know, I promised I would never tell my foster mom that I would that happened. And one day, drunk, I called her and told her. And of course she said, "You're crazy, you're inventing things, and,
right,
you know, why are you doing this to me?" And, you know, and of course, you know, you don't call your foster mom drunk to tell her about your father abusing you.
Right.
So that didn't work that well.
No.
And, you know, it's useless to have done that anyway, because, you know, now, for example, I would never bring it up because it doesn't serve any purpose.
Right.
And she's 86.
Wow.
So, you know what I mean? Like, why even bother? You know,
right.
I think he died. He's the one that's going to have to deal with that,
right,
not me. So.
So, what? How old were you when you turned to drugs then?
Oh, I was young. I was 14.
Wow.
I turned to alcohol first when I was about 12. 12 and a half, 13.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was 15 and a half, I found heroin, and I was like, that's the thing right there.
Uh-huh.
And then I went in and out and in and out and in and out. I would get high for a month and stop and get high for a month. And then I wanted to travel. That was my thing. I wanted to travel and get out of here. And I did a thing that's in the book that's a little funner than the rest. Me and a bunch of people went to sell paintings in Sweden and in Norway and Denmark and in Belgium and in Austria and all that. And that was totally against the law. But for me, it was like a blessing. It was like, oh, my God, I can travel and sell paintings 3 hours a day and drink the rest of the time and take cards and see other countries. That's awesome. I was
right.
And I was only 18, you know. I was like, this is great.
Right.
And so there is a whole section about selling the paintings, and it's kind of funny because we got arrested, we got thrown out of Sweden, and a lot of stuff happened while we were doing the paintings, and it's also a time where I was with a guy that beat me up, and the guy that was doing the paintings became my boyfriend, and he was one of those. So I stayed 2.5 years doing the paintings, and for 2.5 years I stayed with this man that beat me up.
Uh-huh.
And that's another thing. That's the same thing. He hits you once, he will hit you again. Like,
okay.
I never will live that true again, because I know now. I didn't know then. I did not know that. I thought
right.
he... You know, he begged and cried and said, "I'm sorry and I love you." And I thought, I kept thinking he's going to stop. He won't do it again. And
mm-hmm.
it kept getting worse. And it was kind of like drugs. I couldn't get out. And, you know, now I know better. And if a guy touches me, he's out the door.
Exactly.
Now, and I never want to see him again.
Amen.
Because I know that all too well. And so, you know, so that's in the book also.
Okay, great.
So it was around that time, you were 17, 18, that you became a call girl?
Well, before that I became a call girl because the second love of my life broke my heart, and I was like, okay, this is the second time, that's good enough. Now they're going to pay.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought in my little mind of a 17-year-old that, like, if I saw this film, that's in the book, so I saw this film that about a call girl that had all these men at her feet and was like a rock star and had all these gifts, and she felt nothing, and it was funny, and she was always smiling, and she was happy and all that. And I thought, well, that looks good to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that sounds good to me. And I thought, how am I going to get to this, you know, to this place where to know this person that does that in a high class version? And funny, I was always kind of, you know, on the run. So I kept going to Paris and coming back to town, going back to Paris and coming back to town. And I met this photographer that was, like, taking pictures of me all day long. And one day I came to the apartment and there was another girl there. And she was really pretty and she became a French actress. You know, she was really pretty and she was crying. She was saying she didn't want to do it anymore. And she told me about this high-class thing that she was doing. And she was seeing, like, government people and sheikhs and people like that. That we were underage. And so I was like, oh, I want to meet this guy. I want to do this. So she didn't want to do it anymore, so she introduced me to the guy that was doing it. And I took my first plane for the first time to Italy to see a government guy in Italy. And I did that, and I saw a sheikh, and I said, anyway, the guy in Italy was the last guy. And because I hadn't planned on feeling something. I had planned on everything but that. I thought, this is easy. I'm going to make them pay. It's my revenge and all that. And I was the one hurting.
Right.
So it was like, well, this is not working out the way I thought. You know, I'm not smiling.
You thought you were going to hurt him, but you were just hurting yourself.
Yeah. And I stopped because the last time... when I came back from Italy, I stayed 3 days taking pills and alcohol in the bed because I couldn't stand myself. I was disgusted with the whole thing, and the guy kept calling and calling and calling, and I was like, I'm not doing it anymore, man. And he was like, you can't get out like that. And I was like, well, yeah, I can, and I hang up.
Right.
And he never found me.
Right.
So, but at the same time, it's an experience that I wouldn't, you know, like I've learned something. And the guy I saw in Italy was a gentleman, even though he was doing whatever he's doing with underage girls. He treated me right.
Was he doing like pornography movies and stuff? Or
No.
No? Okay.
No. But I haven't had the opportunity, but I think back then I would have if the opportunity came. But I don't know, because I know film stays forever, you know?
Right, definitely.
I wouldn't want a film of me now going around in the houses, you know.
right, definitely.
So thank
so
God
you came to New York.
That.
You came to New York, and were you working?
I danced.
a regular job, or if they know
I
you danced. Said that you were okay, you danced in clubs.
Yeah, I danced for 12 years.
Okay.
But at the time, it was a good job. At the time, it was, for me, it was like, you know, we were topless on the beach for years in France.
Right.
So when they told me you got to be topless on the stage and dance, I was like, easy. You know, it didn't seem hard to me. It seemed like, well, I'm on the beach, naked half the year, so what's the big deal? But, you know, now France is not like that anymore. Now they wear bathing suits. It's so funny. I went back with, and I danced, but I'm a really good dancer. I can dance. And I just danced. I danced really hard, and I made money like that. But I wasn't one of those girls that did extra or anything like that, because I got clean when I was 23, 24. So the first 3 years I just panhandled and was in the street and slept in hallways and did all that. And then I found that job. I was like, you know, I was pretty enough, so I was like, okay, I'll do that. And then I worked double shifts just to have more drugs. So I would work from 12 to 4 in the morning. So I really didn't want an apartment, because I was like, you know, what for? Why do I need an apartment for? I'm going to be there 8 hours. So I slept in hallways and went back dancing. And I carried my plastic blue bag with, like, needles in it and shoes and G-strings until I got clean. And then when I got clean, I danced, but I danced in the daytime, and I wasn't drinking anymore. And so I had a hard time selling drinks and doing stuff like that, but I danced really good, so I always got to work. But then I went back out and I started using again, and I started getting, you know, less pretty and less pretty and less pretty, and my, you know, I got raped and my teeth got knocked out, and I was like, finally one of my best clubs said, look, you see what you look like? You're fired.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
You know, I was missing the front tooth. So,
right.
And I was like scandalized. I was like, what? You're firing me? I'm the best dancer you have.
Right. And at that moment.
Yeah. And so, you know, I couldn't believe it. It was like 7 years I was working there or something like that. And that's when things went really bad. Because then I couldn't dance anymore, and I was not pretty enough to dance anymore. And my habit had gotten huge.
Right.
My habit was huge, so.
Tell the young girls out here, you know, tell them a little bit about what it's like to live on the streets and have to sleep in a hallway and stuff. You know, give them a little bit of advice about staying home and listening to your parents.
Don't do that, first of all. And for me, it was like, you know, it kind of got to the point where it was, okay, which is my favorite hallways? Well, I think that's the one. And I had favorite hallways. I mean, can you imagine that? You know, places where, you know, I felt more safe than others, or it was more comfortable or whatever. But you never get to shower. You never get to, you know, I used to wash my hair in the water thing of Tompkins Square, and in the middle of the winter, you know. And I slept on the bench on Tompkins Square before they blocked it out. That was before. Now I hear you can't sleep in it anymore. But at the time, you could still sleep in it. And I slept on the bench there on Tompkins Square. But I usually went there at 6 in the morning because at 6 in the morning, they don't bother you too much. But the rest of the time, I would sit on the corner with my bag and panhandle, you know, because I couldn't dance anymore, and I had a huge habit. And, you know, it became ridiculous, you know. I would get drugs for other people, and they would give me something, and, you know, I did whatever I could to keep up, you know. But it was insane.
Right.
It was insane. Like, you know, I remember when one night where I was shooting coke, and I had said, I'm doing only one because I have no money and I can't, I have a habit. And I kept going. So I would go away, like a few blocks away to my hallway and shoot coke in my hallway. I remember someone would put a cup of coffee for me in the stairs. And I never drank it because I thought they were trying to poison me because they didn't want me there.
Wow.
I never know if they tried to poison me or if they really wanted to give me a cup of coffee. I don't know.
Right. Or was this really real?
The drugs get you thinking, too, that everybody's out to get you.
You're in the hallway in the building. I'm thinking, they don't want me here. Why would they give me coffee? You know,
exactly.
And then that's without mentioning getting arrested, like you're a criminal. You know, like a real criminal. You know, I can't tell you the number of times that I got arrested and I got sick in jail and was thinking I was gonna die because I was so sick and. You know, stayed 3 days. I was always the first one to get arrested and the last one to go. I never understood that.
Right.
Everybody would go before me, and I was like, what about me?
Right.
When am I getting out?
Yeah, where am I headed to?
Yeah. I was like, oh, my God. And then the last few times, it was the same judge.
Oh,
and finally, the last time, I was like, she sees me, and I was barely standing up because I was so sick. And she said, yeah, we're seeing each other again. And she said, listen to me. This is the last time. She said, the next time I see you here, you will go to prison.
Right.
And I was like, okay, can I go now? You know, because
I just
wanted to go. You know? She said,
right, I'm ready to get out of here.
Yeah. I was like, she said, you need to go to those classes or whatever for 3 months or whatever. I said, sure, no problem. I go to the classes. She said, but understand that if I see you another time, you will go to Rikers Island.
Right,
and I was
right,
like, yeah, I understand. And it just so happened that I didn't get busted in the next month after that. And that's when my leg got swollen and I got to the hospital. But I'm sure that the next time I got busted, I was going to Rikers.
Wow.
I had to get arrested 7 or 8 times already. And, God, every time was a nightmare. So.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a real misunderstanding, you know. But what I want to say is that, you know, we have definitely been an honor having you definitely here on the show. And we definitely appreciate you staying up late to spread your message, and we hope that the message that you brought forward tonight will touch someone's life, that they may change their life as well. And any last shout outs you would like to give to anyone?
I really think that there is a better way to live. I wish I had done it before, but I didn't, and I got to live with that. But, you know, I've learned a lot. And I got to say, it's in the street that I saw compassion and, you know, that I saw things, that I learned things. Like, I wouldn't have the compassion that I've had now if I didn't live certain things. You know, now you don't need to go there to learn that. You can, you know, but it made me who I am today, so I can't, you know, I can't be ashamed of it, or, you know what I'm saying? Like, I can't,
exactly, you know,
I can't be ashamed of it, or, like, you know, like someone was telling me, oh, my God, you got that on your wall, that you've been prostitute, and you've been doing this and that, and you're not afraid of the people, what they're going
to
think, or that. I don't care. You know, in my book, if you don't accept my past or who I am, you don't belong on my Facebook or in my friends.
Amen.
You know, it's like that. I'm
right.
Okay
it is
with
is.
That. Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm okay with that. And you need,
but, you know, there's so
all
many
the
people
young ladies
that
out there need to be okay with what they have gone through and what they are doing, what they have done. They have to accept where they are at and move on.
Right. And that's it. Accept it and take accountability, like you said in the very beginning. Be responsible. Quit blaming mom and dad.
Be responsible.
You know, take responsibility for your own life and make the best out of it. You know, change it if you don't like it.
Exactly. And it's like, it's really hard to see that, like, you're the one that has to change it. Nobody owes you anything just because you've had a hard life. You know, that's not how it works. You know, and I think, like, when you're young, you think, well, I had a hard life, so, you know, you can all kiss my butt because I, you know,
right.
I give back what I got. And that's, like, the easy way out, but we don't know that unless someone told you that there is another way. At 13, at 14, you don't need to go on with the abuse. In abusing yourself.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Because then you become the one that's abusing yourself and treating yourself bad. You're the one that's hurting you.
And
then
for
you
the young
to
ones
be,
that are abused, they need to tell somebody about it and not keep it in.
Exactly.
And get some help.
Yes. But it's very hard, and I understand it's very hard because you're afraid someone's not going to believe you.
Right.
I'm blind.
And I know that because, you know, I lived it. So I know that, like, you're full of fear because you think it's your fault, and it's not. And
right.
You think you somehow instigated it, and it's not. You are not
right.
Responsible for that.
Right.
You are responsible later for what you do with that.
Exactly.
You are responsible if you don't do something about it.
Exactly.
Bottom line.
Right.
No, we do have
so
another
then,
caller on the line.
Okay.
Okay. Well,
let's
yeah.
go ahead and see. We're going to go to the caller with the last four digits of 2854 if you might have a question for Nadej. Caller, you on the air?
All right, you on the air, caller.
Lost four digits of 2854.
I guess they just listening.
Just listening.
Yeah, we thought we had another caller for you, but
okay.
They're probably
just
listening. That's okay. That's great. We do have a few people in the chat room as well, some guests that are listening, so we welcome them and thank them for joining us. And if they have any questions, they can pipe them in for us. Okay, I'll turn it back over to you, Nadej, for finish.
So what I, you know, I try to help the best that I can other people that have the same problem than me, but also the people in general, you know. I think everybody needs to learn compassion and that we all need to learn to help each other. And that's not an easy thing because, you know, you got jobs, you got this, you got that. And it's easy to pass on the side of someone that's suffering without seeing it or without wanting to get involved. And I think everybody needs a dose of, like, compassion to, like, start to see around you instead of you all the time, you know. And I think this world needs more compassion. And, you know, I pray for the girls on 12th Street, like, every chance I get, because I know that some of them are still there. And, right, you know, I know what hell they're going through. It's like not even... You know, like, I don't know if words can even tell
express.
You, express it, express the hardship that it is to be on that street, because that's the lowest of the lowest that you can go. And, you know, it's... And the thing is, nobody was talking to each other. Like, none of us were talking to each other. Well, I was a loner, but I used to look at them and say, God, I hope that they're okay if I didn't see them, you know, in the street. And it's funny because when I was in the hospital, I got caught up in the same room in one of them.
Wow.
And she was one that was probably less likely to get out. And I still tried, when I started waking up in my head, I still tried to tell her, girl, we need to get out. This is just not okay anymore. This is not okay.
At all.
And the problem is, and that's one thing I should talk about, is that methadone thing is not helping anybody. Methadone is good to detox from. You use it for a month maximum. But this program where you get methadone for years and years and years, this is just to keep you off the street. They don't care about you. They want you off the street. They don't want you to steal. They don't want you to bother people, so they give you methadone, which kills you little by little. And you, once you have a habit of that, it takes months to get out of that. So I'm totally against that program, methadone program. It keeps people like us, you know, in liquid handcuffs.
It keeps you, and while other people are making money off of it.
Yeah.
And it's most likely
like
our government.
It doesn't help them.
Right. That's what I talk a lot to the kids out here about, even prescription drugs, because so many kids get into, you know, the medicine cabinet and take any kind of pill. They don't even know what it is. And just because it's a prescription drug doesn't make it, you know, legal, or doesn't make it right to take. You know, it can still harm you. Most of them can harm you. And especially if you take too many of anything, even aspirin or Tylenol, you can have an overdose and die. So, you know,
yes,
because it's
exactly
legal and available doesn't mean that it's good for you.
Yes, but people don't know that, unfortunately. Like, you know,
right.
There's just so many things. I was doing... Like, I remember, because when I was, 12 and a half, my mother took me back. And it didn't work out well, and she had a lot of boyfriends, and she moved from one boyfriend to the other, took me with her. And at one point, me and her hated each other so much that, like, she raised her hand to hit me, and I said, if you hit me, I will kick your butt. And that was that. And she left. She left me there with the guy she was with. And she disappeared. So,
is that when she disappeared?
Yeah. That's one of the times she disappeared.
Oh, okay.
And so she disappeared, and the guy kept me a couple of weeks. And then after a couple of weeks, he was like, look, I like you a lot, but I can't keep you. Your mother disappeared, and I have to call your dad. So he called my dad, and my dad came to get me, and he had prepared a bed with a flashlight in his hallway. And I was like, you're kidding, right? Because, you know, like, my sister had a bedroom for a little girl, Charming, and
mm-hmm.
I had a bed in the hallway. You know, I was like, ugh, you know, this story goes on and on. And he thought I was going to come back live with him. And I think it's a friend of mine that called the 2854.
A friend of yours?
She just wrote me on Facebook saying she's trying to call in.
Well, we can try to get her back on then.
So I decided that, like, this is not what I wanted to do. I wanted to go back to my foster family. The grandfather was dead, and, you know, I could go back there. And she looked at, and my mother was, you know, subpoenaed to the judge. And she looked at me and said, they don't want you. And I felt like, oh, my God, you know, nobody wants me. And she said, you can, if you want, you can go to a foster home for disturbed children. And, or you can go to your dad. And
so
the
court
like,
for the
well,
system
I think
makes
I
you look bad again
the foster
instead of
home.
Right.
So I picked the foster home, where there was 17 girls, all crazy and all disturbed and all abused and all on their way to a really hard life. And I was one of them. And we snit Hitler. You know what it is? It's like that stuff you put on your, you know, when you cut yourself. We snit
mm-hmm.
that. And we were only like 13. And we panhandled in the street of Paris to go to the pharmacy in Pigalle that was open all night. To like, we stopped people in the street to go buy it for us in the pharmacy because we stank from it. It so was obvious that we were sniffing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we were doing anything we could get our hands on already.
Right. Wow. Let's see if your friend's back on the line here. Caller, we have you on the air. The last four digits is 2854.
Hello?
Hello? Hello? We have you on the air now.
I've just been listening on because I've been friends with Nadej for a long time.
Great. Well, she's on the air. You can talk to her, say anything you want.
Oh, I think you're doing a great job. I think you're doing very brave for going on the air and talking about your experience. And Nadej has always been very authentic and able to talk very openly about her life. And she's one of the most resilient women that I know.
Amen.
Right.
Wow. I'm so happy you called in, Melissa.
Yes, I'm just
That's
listening
so cool.
on.
Yeah,
that's
we definitely
so cool.
honored
Thank
to have
you.
On the show tonight, and we definitely honored
I say that
to
always tell
her
that
well.
She has nine lives.
Amen. Yeah,
like
well,
a cat.
Like I tell everybody,
that's
one,
right.
once you come through the storm and you make it on the other side, it's your duty to reach back and help someone else who's going through the same thing or worse. So God didn't, you know, bless her to make it through the storm without a price, you know?
Yes.
Well, that's for sure.
Amen.
But I do have nine lives, I think.
Yeah.
I think you do. There's a few people that do. You're one of them.
I've seen at least two of them.
Yeah.
right.
Yeah, you're dead.
Yeah, it's a definite blessing, you know. So we definitely, you know, just blessing everybody tonight and the people who's in our chat room and listening in. We definitely hoping you have received a great message out of that and great hope and inspiration if you're going through anything of that nature. And we hope our testimony have definitely put something on your heart and on your mind.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's hope so. Let's hope it helps someone to know that there is another way, and, you know, we know there is another way.
Amen. Right. Definitely know that, you know.
Yeah.
So any other last announcements you got to make, babe?
Well, I just want to say... I hope I find an editor and I can finish that book and hopefully help some people that think that there is no way to get out. You know,
right.
because
Amen.
There is a way. And the way is you. So that's pretty much all
right.
I got.
Well, when you finish it, let us know and make sure that you get all your information put up on our website. And
okay,
then
I will.
Then when you do get the book published, you can put all your information up there about it as well, and we'll help get the word out for you.
Yeah, that would be great. I'm going to put tons of pictures, and I paint, you know. I don't know if you saw my paintings. I paint, and, you know, I like
yeah.
to
right.
do that, too.
All right.
Yeah,
so
you're coming back you're coming to Los Angeles?
Yeah, I'm going to go to Los Angeles for probably in November.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, I'm moving back.
Okay. Yeah, I got one announcement to make before we get off the air tonight, and that is to please everybody, don't forget to go support my man, Mr. George Monterano. His fundraiser is tomorrow, August 18th, and it's going to be in New Jersey, if you anywhere around New Jersey area. And we ask everybody to go out and support that event. And if you would like any tickets to that event, you can give Ms. Carol a call at area code 856-863-1164, or you can call Rob at 1-888-491-1255. And once again, we're asking you to go out and support Mr. George Monterano's fundraiser. And we have to be a loud voice in getting these drug laws changed around, because it don't make no sense for a man with a first-time offense of a drug case, nonviolent, going natural life in the prison system. That is crazy and preposterous. And just think of how many people that done committed violent crimes that this man done seen walk out like a revolving door.
Yep.
You know what I'm saying? So let's get on top of that, my people. And me and the Mrs. Newsletter started out in five prisons across the country. Now the Streets Don't Love You Back newsletter is in 40 prisons across the country, and federal and state and men and women prisons. So the newsletter have grown tremendously. And if you have someone on lockdown and you would like them to receive our newsletter every month, please send a reply to the Streets Don't Love You Back at gmail.com. And once again, we're just thanking everybody for all your support and love that you give us. And we're just saying stay up and always keep God first and remember the Streets Don't Love You Back. And thanks again for being on the show tonight, young lady. It's been a pleasure and an honor. And,
You're welcome. I just want to say one more thing. It's like in prison, too, you can change your life.
Oh, amen.
You don't
have
to live like that in prison.
Anywhere you are in life.
You can also find a higher power. The peace is within.
Yes, indeed.
And what I was going to say is that, you know, anywhere you are today in life, you know, it doesn't matter where you've been in the past, but, you know, today you have a chance to start from today forward making your life different in any way that you want it.
And everybody has that.
Everybody has that. It's just a matter of choice and where you want to go and where you want to take your life and what you want to do with your life. You know, everybody has the same choices, and it's just that people make different decisions, and so they get different outcomes or consequences. So, you know, make the right decisions, make good decisions, you know, strive for success and, you know, have the courage and the hope to overcome the bad things that are in your life and reach out to someone like Nadej, who has been there before. Reach out to anybody that you can if you need help. And if one person
I want to say that I'm open to help people if they call you and they need help to talk or whatever.
Okay, great.
And,
sure
I'll give you my phone number
up.
Or my, you know, my Facebook or whatever.
Definitely. And we'll definitely send anybody to you that needs to talk.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we give you a lot of, how do I want to say it? We commend you for overcoming everything that you have. And you know, I know that you went through hell and you know, you almost died with that dirty needle in your knee that gave you sepsis and you know, could have went into multi-organ failure. But, you know, you survived, and God has you here for a reason. And, you know, you've been clean for 12 years, and, you know, God has you here to tell your story and to be able to help other people. And we just really commend you and hold you up and just keep it up. Be strong. Keep it up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank
one
you,
day
Mary.
At a time, but you know, you've come a long ways and you're doing a great job and you are somebody, because God don't make no junk.
I believe that, like, I'm God's child, and God knows me and knows my heart. And you know, when I got clean, I thought, oh my God, I'm never going to leave my life down and never going to feel whole again. And I was wrong. There's a pure part in me that never went away, that was always there, and that is still there, and that nobody can touch. And it's God's part. And so,
you know, and you lived your whole life with an empty heart, an empty feeling, an empty hole in your life. But, you know, as a baby being abandoned and then being sexually abused and then turning to, you know, different things. But, I mean, your whole life, and you didn't know any better then. I mean, because obviously we learn by those
that
teach us and those that treat us the way they do. And so, you know,
right.
It was never your fault, and it turned out the way it did. But, you know, that's why we have to reach out and try to help others, and that's why we have to, you know, tell our stories and be strong. And you know, we're just glad that you have been able to make a change in your life, and thankful that you're here to be able to tell your story on our show.
Well, I want to thank you for having me.
No, definitely.
You're certainly welcome. Anytime.
It's been an experience. Especially because it's like 7 a.m. and I was like, I was going to call at 6:30.
Early,
right.
Yeah,
we're getting ready for bed and you're getting up.
Ain't no doubt.
Yeah,
definitely.
You know? Yeah, so any last say-sos, babe?
I just want to remind everybody to, you know, log into our website and join us as a member on the Streets Don't Love You Back movement website, and that's at streetsdontloveyouback.ning.com. And grab the books if you haven't yet, The Streets Don't Love You Back, and also Never Hit a Woman. And, you know, they're very good reads, hot books right now, and just thank everyone for your continued support, and hop on board with us and continue networking with us. And I love trying to reach out and help some of these kids have a better life.
Amen.
Yeah.
You know? So that being said and done, you know, like we always say here, the streets don't love you back, and each one teach one, reach out to help one. So that's what we're all about. So if you've done been blessed to overcome your adversity, it's your job, it's your duty to reach out and help someone else to overcome theirs and bring them more closer to the Creator as well. So bottom line, what the day is all about at the end of the day, you know? So
that's what it's all about.
Yeah, so I'll leave it up to the missus to go out with the last song, and we'll just do what we do. God bless everybody for tuning in tonight, and stay strong.
Thank you for joining us, and make sure you join us next Wednesday night. Our guest will be Seth Taylor, and we're going to go out tonight with a commercial for one of our other companies, and we will join you again next Wednesday night. Have a great week, and God bless.
Amen.
An awesome product with an untapped market. A debt-free global company with operations all over the world. A compensation plan that is unmatched in the industry. Add it all up and you have the hottest opportunity on the planet today. An opportunity that is about to launch into massive global momentum. Never before has such market timing happened in this industry. Look, the internet is here. Billionaires have already been created. But it's not too late. Why? Because the future is not email and texting. It's about video. And My Video Talk is the company that is going to bring video to the masses. And you can be part of it. Our product is state-of-the-art, easy to use, and priced to sell. Instead of spending millions on TV and advertising, we decided to pay people like you. The product is awesome. The market is huge. The timing is now. Look, this is a global business. It is already proven. People around the globe are making millions. But the company just launched in the U.S. And the U.S. is the biggest market for these products. Are you kidding me? I mean, if you went to a street corner and asked 1,000 people if they know about My Video Talk, chances are maybe only one person would have even heard about it. That means you are in the perfect place right now to capitalize, to be first to market and first to profit. A business that you own with no employees, no inventory, and no headaches. Look, the demand is huge, the company is solid, and the money is absolutely awesome. Don't wait. Get started today.